The following program is pre-recorded.
From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Carl Christensen, filling in for Tom Clark, and I'm here with family doc Zorba Pastor. We're going to spend the next hour with you in our virtual doctor's office. We're missing the random assortment of magazines, though. Sorry to say, Zorba. We're going to talk healthy living. We'll walk through a tasty and usually healthy recipe.
But I can look through magazines when I'm actually looking on my phone sitting at the doctor's office. Come on. There's
a
random assortment.
Yeah.
It's like an infinite assortment of magazines.
Very strange. And little like kids' books and stuff, all kinds of stuff.
You know, it's just you don't have that old, you know, dog-eared stuff from 20 years ago. Please, go on.
Yeah, we got an intro to do here. Yeah. Yeah, we got a tasty and usually healthy recipe. We'll get to some of your emails.
Wait a minute. Tasty and healthy. Tasty and healthy.
I shouldn't say usually. It's always healthy, right?
Always
what
healthy.
About those cookies
that's
we do?
Well, that's an exception to the rule.
And we have phone calls too, right, Zorba? We
got phone calls. Of course, always.
And the number to call if you have a question for the good doc is 800-462-7413. And along with those phone calls, Zorba, we have a few topics to talk
about. Well, we're going to talk about sleep. Now, you have, what, 5 children?
Yeah, two children.
Sometimes
feels
it
like
seems
five.
Like five
yeah, exactly.
children. So getting to sleep is really important. I mean, how much sleep do you get a night?
I'm not a great sleeper.
Well, that's an issue. So
yeah.
Sleep problems have been linked to stroke and issues. We're going to talk about that. And then we're going to talk about chocolate. Chocolate, why does it feel so good? Why is it something we really crave? Why do we like it so much? And we'll go into a bit about the history of chocolate in Montezuma, which I'm sure you probably learned about when you were a child or maybe you didn't learn about when you were a child.
I think I learned about Montezuma when I was in Mexico, actually.
Right. That's very important.
And what is the special recipe today?
Avocado toast with smoked salmon. It's delicious if you like avocado, if you like smoked salmon, and if you like toast. Who doesn't like toast? This is the recipe for you.
Sounds great. To the phones we go at 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Let's get to our first caller now, a listener in Black Creek, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I'm Chris in Black Creek.
Where is Black Creek? And is there a Black Creek in Black Creek?
Yes, there is a Black Creek in Black Creek, and it's just 15 miles north of Appleton.
Got you.
Wisconsin.
Okay. I've never been up there. Never been up to Black Creek.
I haven't either.
Oh.
It's a one-stoplight town, Zorba.
That's okay.
So I do have a sleep issue, but that's not why I called today. I've tried the earwax candles several times, and it seemed because they were made of, I think, a beeswax and paper, that's the only wax that burnt down, and it didn't take it out of my ears. So now what I do is I use, you know, a couple drops of earwax remover or softener, then I use a hot, not real hot, but real warm squeeze bottle in the ear, and then I take a little tool and be real careful on digging it out because I can't get my elbow up there. What people want to know, and I've talked with a lot of my friends, we all listen to your show, and I brag about your show. A lot of my friends are wondering, how does the wax actually get in your ear?
Good.
To begin with.
Good point.
So that's all I got for you guys. Thank you.
It's the wax fairy. See, the wax fairy comes every night.
Deposits it
in your ear. It's not just money under, from the tooth fairy. It's the wax fairy. So first of all, let me tell you about getting the wax out the best way. First of all, we generally say not warm water, not cold water, because people can get dizzy with that. If you don't get dizzy with the warm water, that's fine. But if it's too warm or too cold, it'll activate the semicircular canals in people, and they'll get kind of dizzy with it. And the key to it is you put lots of drops in the ears. Like you say, earwax remover drops are good. Olive oil actually works, hydrogen peroxide. But the drops really... They really do a job. And you just keep on putting them in multiple times so that the wax then becomes, it's sort of like penetrating oil. It just becomes smoother and easier, and then you get it out. If you work with your bulb syringe, if you and your bulb syringe become buddies – you do it the right way, you don't have to use a paper clip or a Q-tip in the ear, which might push that other stuff in there. So that's one thing. Now, the candling, I have no idea why anyone would want to. Weren't you worried when you candled your ear that you were going to burn your hair?
You almost had to have somebody assist you.
That's
and they
right.
put a piece of aluminum foil around your ear and then poke it through there.
I mean, think about it. We got a bulb syringe and we got earwax removal drops. Ear candling, why
right.
is it still there? Candling is out.
How does the wax get into your ear?
How does your
body secrete?
It's made by the external canal. Just like you make snot in your nose, you make wax in your ears. Now, why is it there? Probably to keep out, I mean, believe it or not, even though we want to get rid of it when it gets to be too chunky, but it probably was there from an evolutionary point of view to keep out the dirt, keep out insects. Think about it. You know, you're a caveman, cavewoman. You're in the wild. It's very dirty. There are insects around. Wax would be protective to keep it away from the eardrum because the eardrum is so sensitive and so painful.
And yeah. maybe too much noise?
You bring up a good point. I hadn't thought about that. If the wax plugs your ears, it'll get rid of, it will decrease the noise. Although there wasn't a lot of noise in ancient times, there had been noise all around.
Have you ever heard a woolly mammoth roar?
That's right. Sorry. Pterodactyl.
Sorry.
Got it.
Had to say something about that.
All right. So, yeah, noise and dirt.
Well,
and
hey,
that
guys,
may be the reason.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zorba, and thanks for having me on the show today.
And thanks for listening. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, bye.
Take care. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. All right, Zorba, our first topic of the day. Let's talk about a new study that looked at sleep issues and stroke risk.
And stroke, that's right. So you've got a couple kids, and you know, when you have kids, getting to sleep is not that easy.
It's not easy.
I mean, especially when they're younger. When they get older, getting to sleep is a different issue. When they're teenagers, they just sleep at the wrong time of the day. but they're always, you know, they're in their room or they're sleeping. But when they're younger, it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you sleep well, or are you a light sleeper?
I'm a pretty light sleeper. Mm-hmm. I think I do my best sleeping early in the morning, you know, mm-hmm. 4 or 5 in the morning. Mm-hmm. That's when I'm sleeping really well.
And actually, when I don't do hospital work. I'm not on call anymore. But when I was on call, the worst time to be called in the hospital was between 3 o'clock, generally between about 2 o'clock and 5 o'clock for me.
Mm-hmm.
That was the worst time. I must have been in a deep sleep. 6 o'clock, I'm up and about now, you know, and I'll just get into it. But this looked at sleeping. Now, we sleep, of course, a lot of people snore, they turn, they nap, they wake up, sleep quality. We don't really have a good handle on what it is. I've been asked by people about, like, the iWatch, the Apple Watch, and, like, you know, people have said to me, well, it doesn't look like I'm getting good sleep on the iWatch. We really don't understand what this deep sleep is. We understand it when we put people in sleep studies, but the iWatch really measures movement of your arm and of your hand. But let's look at the study. Carl, when it comes to killing people, what do you think stroke is? Heart disease is number one.
Mm-hmm.
Cancer is number two. What do you think stroke is?
Did you just set me up so I know
just
it's number
set
three? Because I'm going to guess
exactly
three.
Exactly. Right. You're going to guess three, and you are 100%.
You're making it easy for me.
We got to ring a bell. That's number three. It's number three, but when we look from a disability point of view, it's right up there. I mean, cancer can cause people to be disabled. Many people then are cured of cancer, but stroke can disable people. So the issue is, what are the predicators of stroke? So this is a particular study published in the journal Neurology. There were 4,500 people followed in something called the Interstroke Study. 1,800 people in that group had an ischemic stroke, which is caused by a clot. 439 people had a hemorrhagic stroke. Then they matched them by age, by sex, by previous history, high blood pressure, and so on. Generally, people who slept less than 5 hours a night had 3 times the stroke rate than people who got 7 hours of sleep. This is a biggie. But now let me tell you on the other side, people who slept more than 9 hours a night also had a 2-fold increase in stroke. So it wasn't just at one end. It was also on another end. So there's some issues here. We know that sleep apnea can also be associated with stroke, but there may be other things that are also associated with stroke that have to do with sleep in the first place. So I've got some recommendations. First of all, you know, we think about a diet. I got to get my diet better. I've got to lose some weight. We think about exercise. When was the last time you thought to make yourself fit, you should think about sleep?
I think actually quite a bit, but maybe that's just because I don't sleep very well at all. I worry about it all the time.
You worry about sleep.
I do.
So what do you do about it?
I just
What time do you shut off the lights at night?
Oh, it's, well, you know, once the
what
kids.
What time do the kids go to sleep?
Kids 8:30? Go to sleep around 8:30, somewhere between 8 and 9.
What time do you shut off the lights?
We probably go to bed around 11, because then we're going to watch our show or
so
whatever.
So maybe 11 is too late.
It
maybe
probably
it
is.
Should be 10:30.
I know.
I mean, maybe it should be 10:15.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that extra stimulation when you watch your shows, oh my goodness, the kids are asleep, we finally have time. But maybe it's maybe we should be better. Maybe we should just go to sleep a little bit earlier.
I know, Zorba.
I mean, you know, I mean, maybe it's time to get a half an hour more of sleep a night. It may keep you from getting that stroke.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Call in anytime. Leave us a voicemail. And let's go to a voicemail right now. This is a listener in Whitewater, Wisconsin.
I have a question about how you feel about a vegan diet, because I've been vegan for about 7 years now. Went on originally because of high blood pressure. Doctor put me on high blood pressure, and then I realized that after taking that and going vegan for about a month or two, I was actually very low blood pressure. And been off it ever since, and blood pressure's been great. I've been able to eat all the sodium that I want, and I really don't find sodium an issue at all. And it seems like we're just constantly circling the drain towards veganism with the Mediterranean diet and getting closer and closer. So tell me your thoughts.
Circling the drain towards veganism. I love it.
So wait,
circling
veganism's
the
in the bottom of the sink or
right.
a toilet?
The
or
bottom
what
of the sink, circling the drain towards veganism. I mean, that's pretty, that's right. Well, I think the Mediterranean diet is the king of diets. But I think you can do a good vegan diet. And he's a perfect example. He had high blood pressure. He went on a vegan diet. Bang. You know, all of a sudden his blood pressure was taken care of. Sodium doesn't seem to be an issue with him. Sounds like it's a good idea. And if you have a well-rounded vegan diet, you can do fine. It's a matter of getting enough protein. Well, beans are vegan. Beans are high protein. Any pulse, that's what they're called, pulse foods, beans, lentils, anything pulse actually meant that it thickens soups, are great things. And you can be on a vegan diet and do quite well. Now, I myself don't like a vegan diet because I'm an omnivore and I like the tastes of all different things. But everyone has different tastes. I think veganism is fine. I'm much more pro a vegetarian diet, which is a little bit broader because you can have milk and you can have eggs. And then, of course, the Mediterranean diet I still think is the best diet around. Whatever works to get rid of our typical American meat and potatoes diet. What was your diet when you grew up? How did your parents eat?
It was pretty meat and potatoes.
Pretty meat and potatoes.
Yeah, it was. And with
mother,
a little bit of TV dinner
mother,
mixed
what did
in
your
there.
Mother like? We all had TV dinners. We all had Swanson TV dinners. I can still think about it when my mom worked at Weebolt's at a department store. Thursday night, she worked at Weebolt's. I got to have the TV dinner. And if I was lucky, I got to put a sauce on top of the chicken before I put it into the oven. Oh, it was just heavenly. And it was in aluminum. What'd your mother like to serve?
Well, there was a lot of like casseroles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they would make like, you know, make their own salsas and every once in a while my dad would make this this thing that he called it Mexican blowout.
Uh-huh. Mexican blowout.
And that's not, the name
I gotta
sounds
tell you,
terrible.
Mexican blowout is awful.
The
Mexican
name is not
we
good.
Know I mean Mexican blowout, I don't think of food. I have to tell you. From a naming point of view,
we
your
work
dad
on that
was
name.
A zero on the naming scale. I'm sorry.
He should have focus grouped that name a little more.
I think I'll have some Mexican blowout tonight.
But it was
really.
A great
come on
recipe.
Over to the house. We're going to have Mexican blowout.
It was very healthy, actually.
Yeah,
I mean, other
that?
Than the fried tortillas. Yeah, it was basically like you deep fried tortillas. I still make it all the time. Deep fried tortillas in oil. But then it was all chopped vegetables and refried beans on top. You make it's basically tostadas.
Yeah. But you didn't have a blowout from that's right.
Moving right along. as Tom would say, moving right along. 800-462-7413. That's
sorry.
1-800-462-7413. Call anytime. But before we take the short break we have, Zorba, let's check in with your favorite do-gooders.
Da-da-da.
The Grammar Police. Okay, Zorba, this one is actually from a very seldom heard from sect within the Grammar Police. This is from the Pepper Police. Mari in Grand Island, New York.
Hot news.
There you go.
Hot news.
Spicy news.
Please.
Mari in Grand Island, New York writes, Dear Zorba, I stayed silent when you mispronounced. Mispronounced.
Go ahead.
When you mispronounced garbanzo beans as garabanzo.
That's right.
We've heard a lot about that.
Heard a lot? I get it on the street. I'll be pumping gas. People say garbanzo, hey, not garabanzo.
Hey, it's garabanzo,
you know,
doc over there.
I mean, it's like everyone in the world knows how to pronounce the bean but me. I'm just going to call it chickpeas and be done with it.
All right. Mari continues. But today I heard you say pepperoncini instead of the correct pepperoncini, where the N is pronounced.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Poor Carl.
Pepperoncini. Really?
Poor Carl followed in your footsteps, and I can just imagine
everyone
soon mispronouncing it. Yeah.
Is it pepperoncini?
Pepperoncini. It is. I had to actually look it up again because I was a little surprised.
You were certain.
I was very
surprised. You weren't sure. You were like, is this guy real? Is that it?
I Googled it, and I got actually an audio clip of it. And actually, we're going to play it. Do you want to hear
the
actual proper Italian pronunciation of this?
Pepperoncini.
Pretty close. Let's hear it, Brad.
Pepperoncini.
Oh, pepperoncini.
That's good.
Okay, now I say pepperoncini.
There you go. You have to say that every time that way.
Let me hear it again.
Pepperoncini.
Pepperoncini. Pepperoncini.
Not bad.
Now, do they always have like men with baritone voices when they actually do the pronunciation on the computer?
That's a good question.
I mean, sometimes usually it's a woman.
It's, I mean, yeah, well,
but this
Siri.
Time it's a show. Well, Siri's a woman.
Siri's a woman, yeah.
Yeah, she's a woman.
Alexa's a woman,
Alexa,
right?
Alexa. It's not Alexo.
All right. Thanks, Mari, for that. And speaking of the grammar police,
thank you.
This helpful email came to us from Harry in Rock Falls, Wisconsin, who wrote.
Who judges if it's helpful?
Oh, we have so many grammar police out here.
Right.
I had to fit two into this segment.
Right. Okay.
All right. Harry writes, I heard this quote somewhere. You can have friends or you can correct their grammar. Harry goes on. The obvious corollary is, quote, to avoid divorce, simply smile at your spouse's faux pas. End quote. And something I learned here is the plural of faux pas is faux pas, actually.
Faux pas?
Yeah, faux pas.
Faux pas.
So just add the S on there.
Okay.
Or it's already there, I guess. You just don't pronounce it when it's singular.
Faux pas.
All right.
Wait, the S is on there and you don't pronounce it?
Well, don't you say faux pas if it's just one thing?
Yes, faux pas.
But if it's multiple faux pas.
Yeah, faux pas.
Faux pas, yes.
Faux pas.
Anyways,
faux
would you like to join the ever-growing grammar police? Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or, of course, through Facebook.
We have more of your calls to come. Zorba will answer more of your emails and we'll be cooking up some avocado toast with smoked salmon.
Sorry.
That sounds great, doesn't it? You're so excited. You're drumming.
I know.
Drumming on your table.
You got it.
All right. All that coming up on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRX. Carl Christensen filling in for Tom Clark on Zorba Pasture on Your Health. The number to call is 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. But before we get to our phone calls, let's do the recipe.
Yeah.
What do we have here? Avocado toast with smoked salmon.
I love avocado. I love smoked salmon. And I love toast.
It hits it all for you then.
It hits all.
Do you like
And I like it. No, with.
It's very inclusive.
It's with. Avocado toast with smoked salmon.
I should read this thing a little better.
Read the script. Pay attention. Stay on task. That's what your teachers told you.
That's right.
When you were young.
Yeah.
So start out with 1/3 cup of mayonnaise.
1/3 cup mayo.
2 tablespoons of sriracha sauce. And if I am mispronouncing it, please.
We will hear from you.
Let me tell me the way to pronounce sriracha sauce. I mean, it's got the R right after the S, and so it's hard for me to get my, you know, get my organic brain around it. 2 tablespoons of soy sauce, 1 tablespoonful of fresh lime juice, only fresh, do not use reconstituted.
one big tea freshly squeezed lime juice.
A tablespoonful of fresh lemon juice, and you're going to use a little more.
All right, one big tea fresh lemon juice.
Three cucumbers. Now, the cucumbers you use, coarsely chopped, I would generally recommend a Persian or an English cucumber. They are smaller on the inside. The seeds are a lot more. The seeds, I believe, are smaller, but that the pulp on the inside is not as watery.
Three cucumbers, coarsely chopped.
An avocado, coarsely chopped.
One avocado, coarsely chopped.
A tablespoon of fresh, finely and freshly chopped pickled ginger. So you got to get pickled ginger. If you don't have pickled ginger, you could use regular ginger and you could scrape regular ginger and use the zest, a zest scraper to get a tablespoonful. So you could use fresh ginger.
One big tea, finely chopped pickled ginger.
Some kosher salt.
Kosher salt.
4 ounces of smoked salmon torn into bit sizes.
4 ounces smoked salmon torn into bite-sized pieces.
4 slices of your favorite bread. It could be country-style bread. It could be whole wheat bread. It could be sourdough bread, lightly toasted.
4 slices of bread, dealer's choice, lightly toasted.
Dealer's choice.
Do you have a bread
so
dealer?
We have a bread dealer, right. I'm thinking
who's your guy?
Cards on bread dealer. That's right. Dealer's choice. That's right. Come to the house, open up the coats,
open up the
briefcase. They deal with bread.
Some good
toasted
bread.
Sesame seeds, which you can also use. If you don't have it, you don't need it, but
right.
It's really good to have.
Toasted sesame seeds.
That's exactly. What would be your toast that you would use here?
I like sourdough when it gets toasted.
Like
that's usually pretty tasty.
Okay, let's make it. So mix the mayonnaise, sriracha, I'll never pronounce this, sriracha sauce in a small bowl until well combined. Spicy mayo aside. It's off on the side there. Now mix the soy sauce, lime juice, lemon juice in another bowl just to combine it and set this. What do you call this?
Ponzu sauce.
Is that what it's called?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. And set this aside. This is called ponzu sauce, P-O-N-Z-U. It's going to be on the test, so you have to memorize it because it will be on the test, and you get extra credit if you pronounce it correctly and spell it.
Did Bernie Madoff create ponzu sauce?
Yeah, I know.
We'll edit that out.
Oh, place the chopped cucumbers, chopped avocado, chopped pickled ginger in a medium bowl. Season with kosher salt. Squeeze a little fresh lemon juice over that. That's that little extra lemon juice. And then move it around so that you kind of mix it to do there. Now, dip the smoked salmon in with the bite-sized pieces in the reserved ponzu sauce. Add it to the bowl with a cucumber mixture. Toss it gently until it's sort of generally put and distributed throughout. Then spread some spicy salmon mayonnaise over 4 slices of the bread, lightly toasted. Top with the salmon mixture. Drizzle a little bit of the ponzu sauce over it. Sprinkle with tossed sesame seeds and a little bit of crumble if you want to. Toasted seaweed on the top if you're into that. And that is delicious. And let me tell you something. It looks like a lot of work because it is a lot of work to actually put it together. But if you love avocado and you love smoked salmon and you really want to serve something special on a Sunday to your friends, this will cut it.
I like that. This,
this will cut it. And you can get this, of course, on the web at zorbapastor.org. That's zorbapastor.org. Of course, you can always look to that, and you can see wonderful pictures, find other stuff, and, of course, you can find us on Facebook.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. We're going to go back to those phone calls right now, and this is a listener in El Paso, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Pretty good. How can we help you today?
Well, I've got 2 questions. One is a possible treatment for an injury that I have, and the other one is how to negotiate and be able to talk with the right medical staff or the right medical person.
Sure.
So,
what kind of injury?
A few years ago, this is almost 3 years ago now, my wife has horses and a mule, and one of the horses stepped on my toe.
Oh, gosh.
And damaged right at the base of a nail. And, of course, I got a big blood blister underneath it. And I've gone now. I'm a very healthy 75-year-old, and I normally only go to the doctor twice a year for my wellness checks. Or once a year for wellness checks. And the first wellness check after that, I brought that to the attention of the doc. And he said, well, it's going to take 12 to 18 months for that to grow out.
Oh, the nail. For the nail to grow out.
He said, we're just going to have to let it go and see what happens. Second wellness check, and a year later, Doc thought it might be a fungus type thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he gave me some fungus cream, clotrimazole, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to have an improvement, but then that eventually lost its effectiveness. Mm-hmm. So now I'm to my third wellness check, and I said, we've got to do something about this. So I got a referral to a foot doctor, and it was apparently a foot and ankle man, not a podiatrist. And after taking x-rays, which I didn't understand, but he took x-rays of ankle and foot and various things, I really came to no conclusion other than, well, I suppose we could take the nail off. So now I'm trying to determine, okay, where do I need to go next? And I've tried to work through the lines of communication to get to somebody that I can simply ask a question. This is what I have. Are you the person I need to deal with this?
Well, first of all, so does the nail bother you? Does it hurt? What's going on with the nail?
Well, it's now the blood blister, basically. There's two aspects of that. One is that it's underneath the nail, but it's near the top of the nail. It's kind of worked its way to that point. And occasionally it gets re-injured because I stub my toe or...
Oh, gets re-injured.
That type of thing. And so if it gets re-injured occasionally. It generally, on a day-by-day basis, as I'm working or doing whatever, I don't feel it unless I have the wrong pair of shoes on. Or, like I say, a stub it or something like that.
So, first of all, quite often after there's trauma to the nail or the nail bed, a number of things happen. First of all, often a fungal infection fits in. There is a pill, Lamisil, L-A-M-I-S-I-L. It's now a generic, 250 milligrams once a day for 12 weeks. And 80% of the time, it'll get rid of fungal infections. And for the 20% where it doesn't, if they take a second course of the pill, it'll get rid of it. But about 10 or 20% of them never, they just don't go away. So first of all, the cream doesn't do much. Creams really don't work on nails. They don't do it unless you've got something called Penlac, P-E-N-L-A-C, and it's a nail polish that you put on. I think it's every day. I don't know exactly. I mean, I don't prescribe it very much, so I don't remember how often you put it on. Second of all, I think you need to see a podiatrist. And you can go see a podiatrist by yourself, I believe. 75, you're on Medicare. I believe you don't need a referral. If not, call up your doc and say, I want a referral to a podiatrist. I don't want to see an orthopedic surgeon. That was not going to do anything for that. And then finally, the podiatrist may look at the nail and say, let's start over again. Let's remove the nail. There's nothing wrong with removing the nail. It is painful, don't get me wrong, but remove the nail and see whether or not it grows back in a normal fashion. Now, if it doesn't, then the podiatrist also can get rid of the nail bed. They get rid of it. You don't have a nail on your toe. Well, you're not going to be going to, you know, the beach at Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival, where people are going to be looking at your nails. And you really don't need that nail in order to walk correctly. But a podiatrist is the one who's going to look at it. They see this stuff all the time. And you should just get up, call your local podiatrist and say, I have Medicare and Medicare Part B. Do I need a referral? Once again, I never answer insurance questions. And if they say yes, call your doc, get a referral. If they say no, just go in and see him. You need to be on a pill, probably, and you need to have the nail removed. That's what I would do with you in my office.
It was Lamisil, though, right?
Lamisil. It's the name of the name brand of the pill, right?
Okay. Thank you for the information. It's enjoyable to talk to you every week.
Thank you so much.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Let's go to a voicemail now. Let's go to Wabasha, Wisconsin.
If the flu starts in the southern hemisphere, how long does it take to work its way up here to the States? The reason I ask is, I believe the flu spikes here in the fall and winter, and if it does get here quickly, that means it would be starting in the southern hemisphere in the spring and summer. What can you tell me about this?
Well, it's not their spring and summer. It's their fall and winter in the southern hemisphere. So it's our spring and summer, but it's their fall, you know, it's their fall and winter. And why it does this, I don't know. I've never read an explanation of what it is, but it's, you know, it's interesting. It's sort of like a bird migration. It's a viral migration that has continued throughout the world for all of these years. It may have to do with transportation. I don't know if it's worse since World War I. I mean, we've had transportation to that, but it continues around the world. So, I mean, our flu, you know, is here in our winter, and then it heads over there into their winters. So I don't know, for instance, if they do their viral, they make a decision on their immunizations based on what our flu season is. And my guess is that's exactly what they do, because it's our winter that then becomes the time that our flu then travels into their winter.
Interesting. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Just a quick fun fact, Zorba, about Wabasha, Wisconsin.
Wabasha.
Have you heard of Wabasha?
I have.
Have you ever seen the movie Grumpy Old Men?
Yes.
The setting of that movie was actually Wabasha.
Was in Wabasha, Wisconsin?
They didn't
shoot
it there, but that's what the characters lived in, Wabasha, Minnesota.
But why didn't they shoot it there?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Where did they shoot it?
Probably in
Los Angeles. Cali, in Los Angeles. That's right. But they knew. Did they go to Wabasha, Wisconsin? I mean, Wabasha, Minnesota?
To shoot it?
Yeah. No. To find out if that was really what life was like.
Like to location scout it? I'm not really sure.
Well,
that's
you know
something?
I should
do more reading.
Or somebody will chime in at ZorbaPastor.org and let us know.
All right. Before we take the break, Zorba, let's do that segment where we give some of your naysayers some airtime. This is Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc.
All right, Zorba. The following voicemail came from a listener named Marisano from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, who writes, "Dear Zorba, I was just listening to an episode of your program in which you derided? I'd say derided.
I'd say derided.
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 Derided sounds like it. No, it sounds French. Derided.
Derided. You derided a listener who wrote in claiming that one should not use tap water to rinse their sinuses on account of its possible contamination with amoebae. And by the way, amoebae is plural. You probably knew this.
No,
for
I
amoeba.
Didn't.
Amoebae.
Oh, I didn't
I did
know
look that
amoebae.
Up too. Yeah, they got it right in here. Yeah. And
it sounds like a pinball machine.
Amoebae.
Amoebae.
A lot of plural stuff
Pacino,
today.
Pacino, amoebae.
We had faux pas.
That's right. Amoebae.
Plural and hardy over here. Anyways, Marie Sano continues. According
plural and hardy. You know something? Your brain works in strange ways.
Maybe there's amoebae in my brain causing these terrible puns.
Come on.
Anyway, Marie Sano continues. According to the CDC, it turns out that listener was correct. Amoebae can be pretty tough customers, so I wouldn't automatically discount them. And then he also sent a link and some research on this exact issue, which you read.
So we looked at the link. So first of all, let's look at where the problems have. So according to the CDC, between 1962 and 2022, that is 60 years, there have been approximately 157 cases over 60 years of amoeba essentially going into the brain and having trouble.
Okay.
Now, where do these amoeba come from? So the amoeba come from if you're in the water and there happen to be amoeba in the water. In other words, you're swimming in contaminated water, or your tap water is contaminated with amoeba.
Which happens, apparently. A little bit.
Which happens. Let me explain. It happens in places where people know it's contaminated with water.
Okay.
It can happen in very rustic areas. It can definitely, just like Giardia, happen in certain wells and other things.
Okay.
So the CDC, in their infinite conservatism, and they are conservative and they should be, has recommended boiled or distilled water preferred.
For using a neti pot.
Okay, but I want to get back to boiled.
Right.
And if not boiled, it should be sterile or distilled. If boiled is not available, you should use a filter. Okay, so you could use a filter on your neti pot. So let's look a little bit deeper at what the CDC recommends. So if you boil it, it means it's not going to have amoeba, okay? Now, if you're using city water tests for amoeba. They test all the time. They test for Giardia. They test for amoeba. The chances of an urban water supply having amoeba are small. They are not zero, but they're probably less than 0.01% within the country. Now, with a well, kind of depends where you are. In southern states, there are more amoeba problems than in northern states, especially in the summer. Now, if you use boiled water, you get rid of the amoebas. So it doesn't have to be distilled. If you're using sterile water or distilled water, you want to get it, that's fine. If you're using bottled water that you buy, it's not going to have amoeba in it because they check it with that.
Okay.
So I think it's, I want to go back on my derision. I shouldn't have derided it. I think choose your tap water correctly. But if you want to be super safe, just get a bottle of water and use a bottle of water. That's going to be easier. Distilled water, you got to get the jug. It's 8 pounds. You have to bring it home. It does not have to be distilled. Bottled water is fine. And you can get bottled water anywhere in the country for a buck.
That's good advice. Are you looking
you
for...
You mean that it only costs a buck?
Just to use, yeah, just to use
filtered
bottled water. I mean,
I've got bottled water right here. What do you have in front of you? Seltzer.
I'm not going to use seltzer water in my nose.
Seltzer with... Cherries? That's what you're drinking this morning?
It's a black cherry fizzy water.
Black cherry fizzy. I don't think I'd put that in my nose.
No. Okay.
No fizzy water.
No fizzy water through the nose. That's good to know.
I'm trying to think of what it would smell like. It would be terrible. I do use a neti pot with fizzy water. Maybe that would be a better neti pot. Now that I think about it, if you use carbonated water, I wonder what that would do to your... Anyway, let's not go there.
Don't even... Let's not even... Are you looking for people to listen to some quality nasal hygiene tips? Well, sign us up. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at...
Zorba@WPR.org. I said you should have gone into advertising. From Mad Magazine.
Okay. More of your calls to come, more of your emails, and another interesting topic to discuss. All that coming up on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRX. Carl Christensen filling in for Tom Clark on Zorba Pasture on Your Health. The number to call in anytime is 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. But before we get back to those phone calls, Zorba, the headline on this one got me. So here's the headline on this topic.
I got it. Go.
Why chocolate feels so good, it is all down to lubrication.
Yeah, no, it really is interesting. Do you like chocolate?
I love chocolate, especially really dark chocolate.
Yeah. You love dark chocolate.
Love it, yeah.
Do everyone in your family likes chocolate?
Yes,
your wife
sure.
likes chocolate?
She does.
Your mom and your dad like chocolate?
I'm not sure about that. I haven't really noticed them eating chocolate.
I love chocolate. You know about Montezuma? I mean, you know, it was the drink of the gods, and it was bitter. Nobody had ever put sugar. They didn't know there was no chocolate candy. You know, they didn't make anything sweet out of it. And then I don't remember the exact history of who made, you know, added sugar to it. And all of a sudden it's, oh my God, look at this.
It changed everything.
But scientists were kind of looking at the process of really trying to make a healthier chocolate. Can you make a chocolate that has less fat and less calories? And that's kind of what they're looking at. And fat clearly played a role. And it appears that when fat comes into contact with the tongue, and after that, the cocoa particles are released, that's an important part of when we have chocolate. We think of chocolate as smooth and delicious and creamy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you've ever, like, put cocoa on your tongue. It doesn't taste really very good at all.
Right.
It's kind of a bitter taste, you know, which it has. But chocolate has from 5% fat really up to 50% fat. And if you look at the fat in typical chocolate that we Americans eat out of chocolate bars. By the way, what's your favorite chocolate bar?
I don't know the brand names. Usually some kind of, what is it?
Oh, you don't know the brand names? How could you not know the brand names? There's a handful
that I rotate in, but they're always really dark.
I mean, I'm a Hershey's chocolate person. I love
That's not dark
Hershey's
enough.
Chocolate.
Even the special dark,
yeah,
it's not
no,
dark
I
enough
like
for
milk
me.
Chocolate. Hershey's or Snickers.
I mean, it's a classic.
Snickers. I mean, I go to it. But if you're going to dark chocolate, you know, then I'm going to the more expensive chocolate. And dark chocolate is good, but I like that lighter taste. But luxury chocolate often is what they're looking at. They're looking to make a dark chocolate to find out if they can make something that works. And what they found out, when chocolate is in contact with the tongue, it releases a fatty film that coats the tongue and other surfaces in the mouth. And it's this fatty film that makes the chocolate feel smooth throughout the entire time the chocolate is in your mouth. So they believe that if they can make a chocolate candy that is gradient layered, so there's more fat on the outside and less fat on the inside, that'll give you the chocolate that you love, the dark chocolate you crave, with less fat.
Okay.
And I'm all for that.
I'm all for that, too.
I mean, chocolate is manufactured. It's made. Why not make a better chocolate? Why not make a chocolate that's healthy that we can have every single day? It's not a chicken in the pot, in everyone's pot. It's chocolate in everyone's mouth for good health.
That sounds great. I'm all for that. I would vote for that all day long. And it's funny. I have a, you know, going back to the whole mouthfeel of chocolate, I know somebody who is trying to convince me, you know, there's a sensation that's exactly what you're talking about when you first take that bite of chocolate.
It is,
you know,
that first bite.
This person, there's also a sensation when you get into a hot shower, you know, like right when the water hits you, there's kind of a tingling or a sensation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what this person does, and I won't say their name, they were trying to convince me to
take
a bite of dark chocolate as you hit the hot water in the shower.
And
it's like this double sensation. Like
Is this a little too spicy for public radio, maybe?
No, but I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
No, maybe I'll try.
It depends
on the kind of
chocolate. If you get chocolate with spice in it, would be spicy.
Which is, I've had that. That's great.
That's pretty good. I've had that. I've had chocolate with peppers.
Little peppers in there?
Chocolate.
Love it.
Chocolate.
Love chocolate.
Every time.
My mouth is watering. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Let's now hear a voicemail. This is a listener in Cronenwetter, Wisconsin.
My question is, after people have stents, a lot of times they're told that that stent will last only 10 or 15 years. Why don't they do a screening of people at 15 years out or so to make sure that they are not in need of another stent? Thanks.
That, by the way, is a good question. It's not just stents, it's cardiovascular disease. And the answer is, in order to actually screen and find out, you would actually have to go in and do a cardiac catheterization. Well, cardiac catheterizations are a big issue. They're not a small issue. First of all, you'd have to have a slew more cardiologists to actually do it. Second of all, they're very expensive. Third of all, cardiac caths carry a significant risk with them. It's a small risk, but there's a risk that you're going to actually do some harm when you actually do a cardiac catheterization. And there have been studies that have shown that it doesn't actually do anything. That the most important thing after you have a stent is lifestyle changes, medication. So in other words, when you have a stent, you're often put on aspirin. Many people are also put on a drug called Plavix. You have to make sure your cholesterol is low. It's got to be on a drug like Crestor or Lipitor, and I'm using the name brands, but they're both generic now. You've got to stop smoking, drink less alcohol, do the lifestyle changes, eat a more Mediterranean. All that stuff turns out to mean it's less likely the stent will clog. But remember, even if the stent doesn't clog, you may get clogs in another part of your heart because the clog was there because you have cardiovascular disease. Genetically, or, you know, the fact that you smoked cigarettes and did other things when you were younger. So the answer is not to look at the stents, but to look at the body and to make sure that's the case. So that's why we don't go back and retest.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. All right, Zorba, let's crack open the Zorba Pastor On Your Health inbox and take a listener email. The following question came from Liza in Chicago, Illinois. Liza writes, "Hi, Zorba. We hear a lot about the opioid epidemic, but can you share what you know about the rising benzodiazepine epidemic? My husband took Xanax as prescribed for 20 years.
Right.
He began deteriorating, consulted the internet, and discovered he had developed a physical dependence, which his psychiatrist laughed at. That medicine should have never been prescribed for more than 2 weeks. He followed the Ashton manual to wean himself off Xanax, and it was the most horrific thing I have ever witnessed. Uh-huh. He is basically brain injured, an acquired brain injury, crippled with terror, anxiety, physical problems. He's on disability and unable to sleep. Why isn't more about this being covered in the United States? The UK is light years ahead of the US in understanding benzodiazepines. There are online communities filled with these poor folks. Can you please start educating people about this?"
Well, there are a lot of issues. First of all, if we look at the progenitor of the benzodiazepines, it was Valium. And Valium was sold, was the number one drug in the world for about 10 years. And it was given mainly to women. It was saying, women, you have trouble. Your life is having problems. Suburban women, that's actually where the advertising to doctors came from. You know, you have a suburban woman, put her on Valium 5 milligrams 4 times daily.
Wow.
And she'll be much better. She'll feel much better. And then all of a sudden, we're talking about 20, 30, 40 years ago, we realized essentially that benzos were not good. We went to short-acting benzodiazepines, such as alprazolam and lorazepam, Xanax being one of those, the name brand of that. And we do have some people on it. Now, the idea that you can only be on it for 2 weeks is not true. It's better used in the short term. Yeah, that's true for many people. But for some people, they actually need to be on it, and it works well. But that number of people is smaller and smaller and smaller than we used to do. And frankly, most physicians, many good physicians, are giving much, much less benzodiazepines now than they did years ago. And when you mix a benzo with an opioid, you increase the risk of sudden death from the opioid. So the idea is not to have people on benzo when they're on opioids. And for some people, they actually need to be on both of those. Now, I can't talk to this particular case, but what's important is that if he's still suffering, he should see a psychiatrist who relates to this and understands this, because she said, what did she say exactly?
The psychiatrist laughed at him.
Clearly, that's the wrong psychiatrist to see. There are other psychiatrists if he's suffering from anxiety. There are many, many drugs that are very useful for anxiety. If he's disabled from anxiety, there are safe drugs to use in the antidepressant field and in the antipsychotic field that work very well for anxiety. He needs to get help.
Do you have a health question for the good doc? Just post on our Facebook page, or you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is the number to call anytime. That's 800-462-7413. All right, let's hear another voicemail. This is a listener in New York.
I am an absolute fan from New York State. Love you both. My question, all of you, my question is, I just heard Dr. Zorba say, when he's talking about drinking sugarless drinks, you know, diet sodas and things, that it changes your biome. If you have saccharin all the time, blah, blah, can it make you pre-diabetic? In other words, sugar is related to prediabetes, and does it change you so that you are then can be diagnosed with prediabetes? Thank you. I feel great joy when I listen to your show. Thanks so much.
How nice. What a wonderful, what a wonderful voicemail. Well, first of all, I hate the term prediabetes. And I hate it because it implies you're going to get diabetes. It's like pre-diabetes, diabetes is down there. Turns out most people with pre-diabetes do not develop diabetes if they make lifestyle changes. Exercise more, eat less sugar, eat less carbohydrates, you know, go on a healthier regime. You don't get diabetes. So it's not really pre, it's may get diabetes. We need to have a different term there. Second of all, we know sugar does it. There's no evidence that saccharin, stevia, sucralose, or NutraSweet are actually going to produce diabetes. But we think they may change the biome of the colon and maybe of the intestine, and actually not attenuate appetite, but increase appetite. So in other words, you taste something sweet, and your body says, where's the calories? And we start eating. And I think that's the point. The point is, the rise in obesity parallels the rise in diet drinks. And notice, Coke Zero doesn't call it Coke Zero. I mean, they no longer call it Diet Coke. They call it Coke Zero. Gave it a better name, and people will drink it.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. All right, before we head out today, Zorba, let's do the segment where we feature what our wonderful listeners are writing on the Zorba Pastor On Your Health Facebook page. This is Facebook Feedback.
Facebook Feedback.
All right, Zorba, the following question came from Kathleen in Pound, Wisconsin, who writes,
I've been to Pound.
I've never been to Pound. I don't think I've even heard of Pound.
I've been to Pound.
Where's Pound?
We had patients from Pound. Somewhere away from Madison.
Okay.
I have no memory of where it is. Kind of up north to the right.
I think you're right
That's
on that.
That's somewhere
answer.
To the right.
Yeah.
I had patients who moved to Pound and came back from Pound, and I went through Pound.
Okay.
I don't know if I stopped in Pound, but.
Anyone from Pound? Please email us.
That's
Let us
right.
know. Where
That's
is
right.
Pound?
It's near Ounce. Sorry. 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 It was typically a comment you would make.
You couldn't wait to say
no,
that,
I couldn't.
Could
right.
You?
Right.
Is okay. Kathleen says, is colloidal silver safe to use on your lips? I have a red rash around my lips after traveling to Antarctica. I wore a lot of sunscreen, but my lips were badly burned. I went to a dermatologist mm-hmm. and was given triamcinolone. Mm-hmm. Acetonide.
Uh-huh.
Did I get that one right?
Yeah. We usually just call it triamcinolone.
Okay. It's an ointment. Yeah,
you don't need the second term.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. TMC.
TMC.
We call it TMC.
And she writes 0.025%.
0.025. The right dose.
That's
right.
good. But it wasn't effective.
Uh-huh.
My niece suggested the mm-hmm. colloidal silver. Uh-huh. Any suggestions? Uh-huh. And by the way, mm-hmm. I absolutely love your show. Mm-hmm. Very practical and useful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Uh-huh. You could try it. You could see if colloidal silver will work. I certainly would try it for a while and see if that does it. It's going to take a while because it was burned when she was in Antarctica. And a burn can take easily 6 to 12 weeks to totally get better. So it may take a while. But she would try it. Just plain Vaseline on it. It actually is going to allow everything to heal. But definitely colloidal silver, I would try it.
Thanks, Kathleen, for the Facebook question. And, of course, our listeners can always send us an old-fashioned email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Carl.
All right, fine, I will. I'll stay well. If you missed anything during the show or you just want to stream the show online anytime, visit us on the web.
At zorbapastor.org. Of course, you can always connect through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime.
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 That's right, 24/7.
I thought we'd keep doing that for
24/7.
A while.
24/7, anytime.
Anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's right.
It is not intended as a medical diagnosis.
It is not.
Please do check with your doc.
You must.
Our executive producer is me, Carl Christensen.
That's right.
Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg.
Ba-ba-da-da.
He's sitting right over there behind
That's
the glass.
Right.
There
That's
he
right.
is. Oh, he just
That's
gave
right.
us a nod.
Looking.
That's great.
Oh, that was a nod?
That was,
a little,
it was an up
else.
Nod. It went up.
Nod. It was an up nod.
Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran.
Da-da-da.
For Zorba Pastor, I'm Carl Christensen, asking you to join us on the next
Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Did you miss something on today's show? Simply go to ZorbaPastor.org to catch up on all things Zorba. There you will find recipes from the show, links to the Facebook page, Zorba's Healthy Living articles, and you can subscribe to the weekly podcast. On the web, that's ZorbaPastor.org.